You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is the 15th of July 2016 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. Once again today, I'm joined by my two co-hosts, Mr. Dennis Waugh, who's the producer of Adolf Hitler, A Greatest Story Never Told, and Messerschmitt, who is going to be producing part three of his General de Grell series. So, how are you doing today, Dennis?
This isn't Dennis, this is a clone. Dennis is fast asleep, and modern technology has quite been the way to stand in for him. I'm fine.
A genetically modified one, I bet, as well.
Yeah, it can't be too identical, can there?
One that can stay up for 24 hours a day working on editing communism by the back door.
Yeah, it's probably longer this time.
Well, I see you've got part 20 out this week, and we'll be discussing that a little bit later on in the podcast. Messerschmitt, how are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. We had some cold and cool weather here, but they predict that it's going to be the return of summer, so I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, well, we could do with a bit of sunshine here as well. It's a bit miserable at the moment, but not nearly as miserable as it was for General de Grell during World War II. Where did you get us up to last time in your presentation?
Well, last week we had stopped at the moment where, well, after the providential attack of the Stukas, the Walloons and the remaining SS men reconquered that village, Gromovaya Balka.
I think I remember that now. Well, do you want to continue from there?
Yes, and by the way, I found satellite images of that village, and it still looks quite like de Grell describes it, with the two ponds and the buildings on either side of the ponds. So if people want to look that up, I actually posted the link to it on the Daily Stormer comments beneath our re-upload of this show there.
And that's not the ones with the cardboard cutout buildings? Like,
no.
This different one.
Okay. No, I don't think they still have those under Putin now. Yeah. I think those times are gone.
Yeah, thank God. Okay, well, please continue then.
Okay, so they had taken a lot of prisoners, Mongols, Kyrgyz, and Siberians. And those were quite flabbergasted at the fighting spirit of the Walloons and the SS. And they kept repeating, Belgijski Karoch, Belgijski Karoch, which means Belgians, famous. And, well, all of the wounded Belgians and SS were dead, as they were deliberately crushed by the Soviets with their tanks, as I mentioned last week. And the rest were killed with bayonet at thrusts. A while after the Stukas had left, the Soviets came back at them again. They still had a huge numerical advantage, and some of their tanks had survived the Stuka attack. De Grell's men had no anti-tank weapons. The Panzerfaust had not yet been developed. They started arriving at the front in 1943. Nor did they have any anti-tank gun. The German 100th Jäger Division had been sent to support the Walloons in their struggle, but a German panzer column that was supposed to clear the way for them ran into a large group of Soviet tanks, and the ensuing battle, which lasted for hours, delayed the reinforcements. So the Walloons and the SS were on their own again. They were forced back by the approaching tanks and overwhelming numbers of the Soviets. They defended each hut and each barn as long as they could, but eventually the survivors were gathered at the last houses in the southwestern corner of the village. If they were forced out of these last strongholds, they would be thrown out into the steppe, flat, without a bush, covered by deep snow, with no cover at all. They would be, in other words, doomed. The commander of the Walloons, Captain Pauly, gathered together the remains of all the companies and grenade in hand, was the first to rush to the counterattack, shouting their old cry, Rex will win. All who could still fight followed, including the armorers, the cooks, and the truck drivers. They darted from hut to hut, avoiding the Soviet tanks, which were running out of shells to fire, engaged the Soviet infantry in hand-to-hand combat inside the huts, or firing at them at point-blank range. The Soviets panicked and were exhausted. First they hesitated, and then they began to give ground. And then, in the thick of the hand-to-hand combat, some German infantry reinforcements appeared in the snow to the west, and the Panzer, victorious in the battle with the Soviet tanks, showed up on the crest of a hill. The enemy rout was then complete. For a third time, the village had been retaken. Night was about to fall, and 700 Soviets were lying dead, scattered all across the village. But 250 Walloons and SS had become casualties as well, killed or severely wounded during those 12 hours of furious fighting. And to quote de Grel again, "For 10 days we had gotten our bearings and had worked hard. We had held on to the village in spite of 4,000 Soviet soldiers and 14 tanks, only because the honor of our people was at stake. All of us preferred death to giving ground. A burning patriotism inspired our soldiers. They were representing their country. For it, half of our men had fallen, frozen in death, bathed in blood. Only national pride had enabled the miracle of 3 counterattacks and the reconquest. Many of the surviving wounded were hit the second time when the medical convoy evacuating them, clearly marked as such, was fired upon by the Soviets. By the morning of the 2nd of March of 1942, the Wallonian Legion had been reduced to less than a third of its original strength. Out of 26 officers, there remained 2, one of whom, suffering a nervous breakdown, was evacuated a short time later. But tales of the heroism of the Walloons were now spreading all along the Donetsk front. The commander of the 100th Jäger Division had awarded them 33 Iron Crosses, and they were honored by being mentioned in the Wehrmachtbericht, or Wehrmacht Report, of the day. De Grel doesn't mention in his book that he was one of the recipients, but I looked up his decorations, and the date for his Iron Cross Second Class matches that given date. During the Battle of Gromovaya Balka, he was promoted from corporal to non-commissioned officer, according to the English translation. And he states, quote, "I love the life of a soldier, simple as could be, free of worldly concerns, ambitions, and interests," end quote. Now, getting shot at all the time seems quite a worldly concern to me, but I guess what he means is that life was very basic and simple. They did not have to worry about daily things, superficial and vain things like fashion or career or otherwise necessary things like politics. And here again I come to a part which I find interesting. What did the soldiers discuss amongst themselves? And I'm again quoting, "We often received visits from our German comrades. We would even go to spend the evening in their shelters. For hours we would discuss the problems of the post-war period. Beside the dead, what would there be? The questions about frontiers, about material affairs, didn't interest us very much. Living ceaselessly face to face with death, we came to understand to an intense degree the importance of spiritual forces. The front held only because at the front there were souls, souls which believed, which burned with ardor, which radiated strength. Our victories were won not only with weapons, but with virtues. The problems of the post-war period would be identical. Economic victories would not be enough. Political reorganizations would not be enough. A great moral redemption would be necessary, which would cleanse away the blemishes of our time, which would restore our souls with the fresh air of passion and of unconditional service. National revolution, yes. Social revolution, yes. European revolution, yes. But above all else, a spiritual revolution is a thousand times more necessary than external order, than external justice, than fraternity in words alone. The world emerging from the killing and the hatred of the war would need, first, pure hearts believing in their mission, dedicating themselves to it, pure hearts in whom the masses could believe and to whom they could devote themselves. Our discussions blazed to life like fires. A paltry little gas lamp emphasized the lines in our faces. Those faces radiated. That winter we offered up our sufferings for the purification of our dreams. Never had we felt in our hearts so much strength, so much clarity, so much joy. Once we had been able to lead commonplace lives soiled by petty abdications to daily necessity, the front had given us a taste for privation. We were purged of all hatred and of all desire. We had mortified our bodies, extinguished our ambition, purified and offered our sacrifice. Death itself no longer frightened us. End quote. Personally, I think this passage not only shows his idealism and political passion, but also his Catholic spirituality shining through clearly here. Now, moving on to another subject. How the Germans, and in this specific case, the Belgians, interacted with the local population. If you remember how Hans Ulrich Rudel described his encounters with the Ukrainian and Russian civilians, you will find the following quote matches what he tells us. The natives received us with obvious joy. Often we were the first troops to enter their hamlet. The good people immediately went to the outbuildings, removed their icons from their former hiding places, and hung them once more on their dry mud walls, tears streaming down their faces. The greatest gift that one could confer on them was to give them a portrait of Hitler. Often they would hang it next to their icons. They would even put it between the photos of their boys, dressed in the uniform of the Soviet Army, red stars on their caps. Such photographic fraternization appeared perfectly natural to them. They loved their boys very much. They loved Hitler very much for having liberated their village. They combined the two. Very strict orders had been given that the troops be friendly with the population. End quote. And returning to another battle experience, I will quickly set the scene and then let de Grel himself again tell the story. The Walloons were now attached to the 97th Jäger Division. Its commanding officer, Lieutenant General Ernst Rupp, had sent the two infantry regiments of the division in different directions, and in between them he advanced, covered only by a general staff company. As de Grel puts it, these men had more specialists in pen pushing and rubber stamping than in machine guns and grenades. Everything seemed to be going great, but then suddenly the Soviets started coming out of hiding and cutting off the roads. They had walked into a trap. General Rupp and his small company were surrounded in the village of Shirvanskaya, which, by the way, can also be looked up on Google Maps. The old orderlies, the secretaries, the veterinarians, and the supply sergeants fought as well as they could, but the Soviets were closing in. The Soviets occupied a high point at a crossroads and had established a formidable position there. The Walloons had received an urgent radio message ordering the Legion to cover, that same night, 20 kilometers of mountain and then hurl itself at the enemy, relieving the divisional command post at Shirvanskaya. It was a starless night, pitch black, and after an hour of marching, the Walloons found it impossible to continue. One of them had badly injured his back, and several horses had fallen into precipices hundreds of meters deep. At 2 a.m, they resumed the march, and after long and exhausting hours of marching, they finally came to that forested hill where the enemy was entrenched in his positions. Oh, and by the way, this is in August, so and they had no summer daylight savings time, so at 2 a.m, it would already slowly start to dawn, so they could keep moving. The Soviets had artillery, motorized transport, and some captured anti-tank guns. And now to the quote. The frontal attack promised to be lethal. Therefore, I took 3 volunteers, all of them expert in combat, while the companies advanced as well as they could. I threaded my way along the right flank, reaching some holly groves, then the forests, and succeeded in crawling between the first Russian posts. My 3 lads followed me at a distance of 10 meters. I wanted to flank the enemy. I arrived right behind him. I could see the Soviet camp through the branches. At that very moment, our men were scaling the slopes to attack the Reds. This was it. I leapt out behind the Bolsheviks, raking them with machine gun bursts and unleashing blood-curdling shouts. My companions stormed right behind me into the middle of the camp with a similar uproar. Panic reigned. The Reds, believing themselves cornered, ran about in circles, finally fleeing in utter confusion into the ravine to the southwest. They had gone completely mad. The 4 of us alone had chased them from their lair. All the trucks were ours, magnificent Ford trucks, drawn up in a square, keys still in the ignition. The cannons which had shelled us were also in our hands, as well as 10 machine guns. Supplies, equipment, ammunition, helmets overflowing with fruit. Nothing was lacking. Our cries and our bursts of fire, exploding suddenly behind them, had been enough to convince several hundred Reds of disaster and to drive them across the plateau. We sped after them, howling all the louder and shouting off all our and shooting off all our machine gun clips. Shortly afterwards, one of our companies, arriving on the double, met us at the crossroads. End quote. And next week, we'll hear some more of Degrelle's daring adventures before we turn to the tale of how he survived the war and avoided capture.
Wow, that's... I mean, the first thing that really strikes me about that is the first battle that he was involved in, where they didn't have any anti-tank guns. I mean, obviously, the only tactic you can use then is to just dodge the bullets until the tanks actually run out of missiles to fire at you. I mean, that must have really been quite something. I do really appreciate you doing these presentations for us, Schmidt. I know our listeners do as well. It's fascinating hearing about these war heroes. I mean, you think of the odds that they were fighting against, 4,000 Soviets at one point there, in inhospitable conditions that they're not used to. But I guess it makes it all worth it when they liberate people, and they liberate the people who they have liberated want to put pictures of Hitler up there amongst their religious icons. I mean, today we ridicule and we mock the Middle East for showing their pictures of Bashar al-Assad, and when they used to show up these pictures of Muammar Gaddafi. The BBC and the news, they always used to mock them and say, oh, these dictators, everybody's forced to hold up these pictures of them. But they're not forced to hold these pictures up of them. You know, when you have a good leader who really does his best for the people, really does give real social justice to the people and lets them own their own homes and raises them up out of poverty, then the people are really pleased about this. And they genuinely do love their leaders, just like we used to genuinely love some of our kings that we had, some of our monarchs. You know, when we would say God save the king, we really meant it. It's just that we in the West now, for so long now, we've had dreadful political leaders. We just can't understand that somebody would love the leader of their state as much as that. But it's obvious that these people that Degrelle liberated, they did, and Hitler wasn't even their leader. He was just the one that had liberated them from the Soviets. And I also found it interesting that he was talking about the fact that we need to have a spiritual revolution. And it was their pure hearts that actually saw them through the battle. And that's what kept them going at the front. And it doesn't matter what economic changes you want to make, what political changes you want to make, unless there is a change in spirit, then it will all come to nothing. And when you think about the absolute tragedy that was the Second World War, and we've never actually got over it, we've never had a chance to get over it because we've only ever been told lies about it. You know, we committed this absolute atrocity against our German brothers, and we've never been able to actually come to terms with that because 99% of our population don't even realise it. We don't even realise the injustice of what we did. We think that that they massacred 6 million Jews and they deserved it. Half of us don't even know about the firebombing of Dresden and what was actually done to Germany. And yet we were the ones that did that. We were the ones that were guilty of that. And we've never had a chance to actually come to terms with what we did to pay for our crimes because we don't even know that we did them. So, you know, when he was saying there that that's what we need is a spiritual revolution and pure hearts, we've never had a chance to actually have that, which is why we ended up with the European Union, and we ended up in the state that we're in today, I think. Dennis, have you got any comments you'd like to make on that?
Yeah, well, I'm sure the listeners know that Leander Grell is my all-time favourite general. The thing which I found fascinating was when he said that they'd come to terms with being on the front and they'd actually purified themselves. And so what you're talking about here is that actually the dead can't die. They've kind of committed themselves to they're already dead. They're purified. They made their word with God. And so, you know, let the battle commence. A mindset which is a nightmare for the enemy.
They're actually absolutely fearless of dying. There's nothing more that can be held over them. You know, that's what faith does, isn't it? You know, because people have faith that they're fighting for the correct cause. If they do die, there's life that carries on after death. So they are going to be fearless. Yeah, this is what the people used to fight for. They weren't fighting for wages. They were fighting because they thought that they were fighting on the right side, on both sides of the war. This was true. And it wasn't just Leon de Grelde and his men that believed that they were fighting on God's side. The British did as well. The Allies thought they were fighting on God's side. It was just these evil people at the top that knew what was really going on, that it was just a war for the bankers. I mean, we see this fearless behaviour even in ISIS, don't we? Because they think they're going to go off to paradise with all their virgins afterwards. I mean, they're quite happy to blow themselves up.
At a young age as well, yeah?
Yeah, the power of actually having a faith and having a religion is something that we just seem to have forgotten nowadays. I mean, atheists, they're not going to blow themselves up for some abstract idea. They're not going to go and put their lives on the line for some abstract idea of democracy or freedom for homosexuals to bugger one another in the streets. You know, they're not going to lay down their lives to fight for that. But yeah, people are going to lay down their lives to fight if they think they're fighting for their God, or if they think they're fighting against the enemies of their God, then they're willing to do that. And this is the strength that we had that enabled us to go out on these crusades, I think, in the past. It's also the strength that enabled the British to defeat Julius Caesar. And he wrote that as well. He said that the British are so fierce because they believe in life after death. This is why they're such fierce fighters and fierce warriors. You know, it's so important that we actually have a faith. And Schmidt, have you got anything else that you'd like to add to that?
Yes, there's something. 6 days after this battle that I last described, he got the infantry assault badge in silver. And de Grelde doesn't mention that he got it or how he got it in his book, but I would think that daring assault had something to do with it. And also concerning what he wrote about this purification in battle, it must be something that is simply hard to imagine for us. But he seemed to have been in some ways happy at the front, and he found his strength in his faith, and there's no doubt about that. And yes, I guess a lot of the Soviet soldiers were raised, maybe they were raised at home with Christianity, but if they went to state school, it was probably They were probably well re-educated, and so maybe that is partly the explanation as to why the Germans could rout thousands of Soviet soldiers with just a couple of hundred of German soldiers.
Well, I don't think the Soviets' heart was really in it. They'd had their whole country taken over by these Jewish revolutionaries. You know, they weren't under any deception that they weren't Jewish revolutionaries. They knew that. Whereas in Britain, we didn't know that Winston Churchill was working for the Jews. The people that actually knew that had been locked up and silenced. And yet, I think the Russians, most of them knew that these people that were bossing them about and telling them to go to war weren't actually Russian. They were Jews. And I think, as a white man, you know, that's the purpose of our lives, is to fight for a just cause. Whether it's fighting to provide and protect for your family, or whether it's fighting to rectify some injustice. I think that's what all white men wish to do, and they find a purpose in themselves when they're doing that. You know, they feel morally justified in going to war and fighting to the last breath, because they believe it is for a just cause. And this goes back to, you can look at the old the Mahabharata, the Indian war epic of the Aryan Hindus, and the Bhagavad Gita. It talks about the reasons for going to war, and in the end, you know, you think, well, lots of people are going to die. People on my side are going to die. People on their side are going to die. But if it's for a just cause, if it's morally right, then you have to fight for it. You know, we are in the midst of a battle between good and evil, and light and dark. And if we don't fight to defend the good, then the good gets snuffed out. You know, that's what it boils down to. And when we do that, we know that we've got God on our side, as you can see there with de Grel winning against all odds. You know, he had God on his side. You know, it's just a shame that it wasn't the right time for Hitler to actually win the war. You know, but at least they still had 10 years of living under National Socialist Germany, and we have that example which we can look to today in order to give us inspiration and to give us hope. It just wasn't quite at the right time. But if you think about it, you know, it was only Germany that really knew about, you know, what the Jews had done, this Jewish conspiracy and this Jew world order. And yet, because of what they found out and what they wrote down and what they taught other people, the whole world knows about it now through the internet. So if it hadn't happened, you know, we wouldn't know that it was the Jews that were running us now. You know, Adolf Hitler's spirit really has risen from the grave and come back again, like he prophesied that it would. Anyway, thank you very much for that, Schmidt. I think we shall move on to part 20 now of Communism by the Back Door, Dennis. Would you like to give the listeners a brief rundown of what it contains? I think you only released it today, didn't you?
Last night, did my usual trick of uploading about 10 versions of finding a mistake somewhere along it. So I've got into the habit now of not filling all the forms in. But this was one which I was intent on doing, because a few weeks ago I had another one of them moments when I realised that my work had clashed with somebody else's work. And this particular person was Deborah Tavares, who explains it in the full lecture, how she came about it and didn't believe it at first, and told her daughter to eventually to go away and find out whether it's true or not. Just dismissed it totally. Whenever she was out with her husband, she would just walk away if any of the conversation went down that road. Consequently, daughter phoned her up in the middle of the night in tears, and she thought there was someone up with the children when she picked the phone up. But no, she said, Mum, it's all true. And what was actually true was the fact that America had gone bankrupt, and Roosevelt and the bankers we're all behind this, and as I mentioned a week or two ago, Europe as well, all the countries in Europe were forced into bankruptcy by this great Jewish scam. The only one country at that time refused to take it, and we all knew who that was. But certainly after World War II, everything fell back into place again. All Europe was back under the Rothschilds, and so laws had been brought out previously which helped the bankers down the years to be in favour of gaining more and more wealth. in all these countries, and this is one of the reasons why we're in the position we are in today. She talks about the silent weapons, quiet wars program, which these are pamphlets which were either leaked or discovered. Another one was Iron Mountain, which was in from the '60s, where they tried to work out in the event of having peace one day, total peace with one world government, what would be the consequences and how would they go about compensating the money which they'd usually generate from wars. And what came from that was this wonderful idea of global warming, which is a way of putting us all under slavery, monopolising all the energy. They want to take it all. They want to actually take gas and electricity. They want to stop the gas. They want to just use the electricity because it's easier to control. They got smart meters and they can charge, you know, a price which we'll all suffer. And this all comes from the debt which they scammed back in the '30s of this bankruptcy, when America went under. They fooled our grandparents and their parents. They didn't inform them of what was going on. And consequently, they had no idea that we were being all, just stiffened really for a future time when the elite would come, the bankers, the Jewish bankers, would come and claim the property that our grandparents had held in collateral when this great crash came in the '30s. So what we are seeing today is the Jews coming to claim this property. We think we own it. We think we own our own houses. We certainly pay for it, but the land itself is not ours, and so consequently, it's neither the house. So, and I could only take maybe, you know, 8 to 9 minutes out of this particular lecture, and I do stress in the notes on that particular part 20. I do recommend people going and listening to the complete, just over an hour, because it really is fascinating just how this tangled web of deceit has taken place.
Well, there's quite a few subjects there that you cover. I think with this collateral idea, it's basically all the taxes that people can produce. That's what they use as their collateral. So the more people there are, the more taxes can be produced. The more taxes can be produced, the more money can be borrowed, which again is at the root of a lot of this immigration, because the more people they can import into the country, then they can use that as collateral for more taxes tomorrow. Where it all falls down is that most of the third world don't want to work. They don't have that work ethic that we have. They're quite happy to just sit there on benefits, aren't they?
Well, maybe they're a bit wiser than us then. I don't know, but you're right in one way. But then again, they are looking to depopulate. There's a little section on Bill Gates where he actually says that he has one wish and one wish only, that all CO2 is abolished from the planet. And if that does happen, then we all die. And I'm sure he knows this, because the plants actually give off the oxygen by taking in this CO2, which I can remember learning at chemistry in school years ago. But consequently, a lot of people forgot about it. And they do believe in this global warming and this, you know, fossils of dead dinosaurs. But, they pushed it, and they pushed it in schools for many years now. Al Gore is one of those who was pretty upfront about it. But it's all total bunkum. It's just another scam, a famous Jewish scam again, just to get the money out of us.
Well, I think, you know, if you give plants more carbon dioxide, they grow bigger. They produce more fruit. If the more carbon dioxide there is, they're capable of taking four times as much carbon dioxide as we actually have now. You know, we found evidence of it from when the Earth had four times as much carbon dioxide, and the plants were all much bigger. And we've got actual evidence of that. So it's not something unnatural for the climate to actually change. What is unnatural is to try and unite all the different races together under one government, and that's what they use it for. As an excuse, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, in another one of her lectures, which I was listening to as well, she's pretty convinced that they can control the weather now. They have been threatening to do that for a few years, going back 20, 30 years, and they reckon that they can do that now. And this is why we're getting, you know, so some of these countries are getting some of these tremendous weather conditions. And it wouldn't surprise me because, you know, technology as it goes on is getting pretty rapid these days, especially with the microchip was something else that kind of, you know, we let leaps and bounds with a computer where I can now actually produce a record, you know, in, you know, a small bedroom. And that's how far, you know, it's gone even further. But another point, which we've done as well is, it's gone.
I was going to say that changing the weather, cloud seeding, yeah, they definitely do that. I mean, they let out small particles from an aeroplane, and what the small particles do is they attract the moisture in the air, so that will create the rain. So they do that somewhere, and it takes all the moisture out of the air somewhere else. So they do that the parades in Moscow. The big parade they have with all the military hardware. They do the cloud seeding
before that.
Don't
tell me it's never rained.
Yeah, it's never rained on it. They say that's what they're going to do. Yeah, they do it for big sporting events, so that it doesn't rain. You know, that is a technology that they have, and of course that is going to upset the balance. You're going to miss out on it somewhere else if you're doing that. But the other part that I found of it that was interesting was this quiet warfare, or this silent warfare, which is basically gradually grinding the people down so that they're demoralized. And all sorts of things are used for this. So in your video there, you highlight the fact that we've got these closed circuit televisions that are watching us all the time. So it feels like we're being watched all the time. And if you're being watched all the time, you're going to be on edge. So that gradually grinds you down. And you've got all the noise as well. You think of the noise in the cities, that there's always a permanent buzz there in the background of all the industrial work that's going on, all the building work. So you've got this constant noise. And the only time you don't hear it is on Christmas Day. Because everyone remembers how beautiful and peaceful it is on a Christmas Day morning. But that's how it should be all the time. Now, all the time you're on edge because we've got all this noise. We've got these cameras there. And then, of course, you point out the electromagnetic waves that we're getting from things like the microwave ovens. And people talk about these smart meters that are doing the same, these radio waves. So they're all things that actually grind us down. You located a book that was describing this as a weapon of warfare against us, Dennis.
Well, it is, yeah. I just want to point out, I didn't manage to, because I've only got 15 minutes. I couldn't get in everything I wanted. But at once over, I used to go to bed, you know, with a mobile phone and listen to documentaries on YouTube. And after a couple of weeks, I thought, my God, you know, it felt like my head was frying, you know, because my ear was right next to the phone. I fall asleep and it's still, you know, still be on. And it's like, you know, and I can understand now why they're such a silent thing. I mean, the guy is actually showing a microwave and he's actually taking measurements of it 4 feet away, where the limit should be 3 and it's at 100. So he's turning around and saying, well, look, you know, not only does it kill all the vitamins and everything in the food that you put in the microwave, it's radioactivating the food, as well as radioactivating you as you're waiting for it to be cooked. And this has been going on for years and years. And they must know about it. And I've always put a connection with that, with cancer, because, you know, the longer we've gone on, the more cancer doesn't seem to go away. It seems to, you know, get more and more.
Yeah, we do seem to have a lot more cancer now than we used to. It's like the mobile phones thing that you bring up. I mean, there's a lot of information to show that it's no good for you to be holding that mobile phone up near your head or having it in your pocket, near your groin. You're showing there that these laptops, and Apple have stopped actually calling their laptop computers laptops.
Right.
They probably don't want to get sued for when people say, well, I've got testicular cancer after having the computer sat on my lap.
It's funny you should say that, because I was just, like I said, I couldn't get it all in, like, so there's really some interesting things. Because they've got the Wi-Fi in the schools, yeah? And Deborah Tavares was talking to a guy who used to be a British agent, who's an expert on these microwaves. And she was asking about in schools, and he says that it's absolutely criminal that these Wi-Fis are in schools, because the kids are so young and they don't realise what's going on. But obviously some people do, and they just, carrying on regardless. But he said in England, it says, they have a system where, when the teacher takes your child, you know, by law, that teacher then becomes, the surrogate parent and should treat that child as the parent would treat it. So consequently, if you drop a child off at a school and there's Wi-Fi on and your child's getting radiation, you know, this teacher really is the parent to blame. So you can actually take them to court. There's a, you know, means of taking, if you've got a complaint, you take them to court. But the problem is it'll cost you in the region of about 13 million because, it takes 3 years for the defense, these Wi-Fi companies, et cetera, who will drag the feet, you know, and put the case forward. And then you've got another 3 years then yourself. So 5 or 6 years down the line, you haven't got the money to take anybody to court.
Well, you'd also have to prove that it was doing this damage. And this is the problem. Yeah. When they do the tests on these new technological improvements, the company that's actually come up with the improvement, they're the ones that pay for the tests. And if you get negative results, then they change the parameters of the test, don't they? Or they pay for somebody else to do it.
We've seen this with genetically. A few films have pointed this out.
Yeah, genetically modified organisms. You know, anyone that comes up with proof that they're harmful, they get the sack and they scrap all those results, and then they'll pay for somebody to do the test that's going to say, well, yeah, there's no harm at all, and that becomes the official results, and they say, look, genetically modified organisms, they do no harm at all. Look, this Dr. So-and-so investigated, and then you look, and Dr. So-and-so funded by Monsanto. This is the same throughout the industries. They're all self-regulating. This is what privatization has done. Rather than doing things in the interest of the nation, these companies are just left to do what they can for profit.
These guys will sell the grandmothers, trust me.
Yeah, I think if you had an ethnostate built on national socialist principles so that nothing was allowed that was harmful to the nation, then you would have a different type of Wi-Fi, you would have shielding, or at least you wouldn't have children exposed to it. You know, you'd have to be an adult and be made aware of the dangers.
And well, using these actually in weapons in places like Syria and places like this, you know, they've got the technology to, you know, to fry somebody, you know, from distance now. So it's, you know,
well, don't forget, we're told pornography is a wonderful thing. We're told this is great, this is free speech, and Israelis use it as a weapon in Palestine and the Lebanon, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. So
we're told a lot of things are good, and they're actually harmful for us. I think in the former USSR, microwaves were illegal because they knew that they did this damage. You know, I've seen reports on that online. I don't use a microwave myself because I've always thought that they're going to be not good for you. You know, it's like making the food.
Can I just say as well, a friend of mine many years ago, when Sky first came out and I was having the thing set up on, you know, with the television and everything, and he said to me, and I never quite forgot his words, he said, always remember, he says, when you can send a signal in, you can send a signal out. And as you notice in that part 20, the camera on your computer, even the Facebook guy, I saw a photo. He has a sticky tape over the camera on his computer. Is it Gutenberg or something?
Well, everyone should be doing that. When I installed Windows 10, they were most insistent. They told me it was going to be installed, whether I liked it or not, in the next couple of days. So I looked into it, and before installing it, I checked out that I got all the anti-spyware for once it was installed. And on one of the pages after it was installed, it takes you to all the permissions that have all been given to Microsoft. And one of those permissions is permission to use your web camera, to keylog everything that you put on the keys, take control of your microphone so that they can hear everything that you're saying. And all these permissions are just automatically taken as if you would just say, yeah, sure, take control of my webcam. Watch me whenever you feel like it. Listen in on my computer whenever you feel like it, and take down everything that I write. I mean, who's going to actually want to be doing that? Nobody's going to want to be doing that. Well, everyone should be very careful with Windows 10.
It's funny you should say that, because Every now and again, I get a little message popping up saying, like, access is required to your information. Do you agree? And I often think, I bet if you press no, that means yes to them. Because if you press yeah, you know, well, who's going to press yeah? Nobody. So, you know, that's something to think about.
Well, and just to take it back to something else that you were talking about there, the way that everything's become corporatized. I've always thought, I mean, this is before I became interested in this sort of stuff and nationalism. I always thought, well, the president of America, don't you have presidents of companies? Where does this, you know, where does this office actually come from? The president. We never had any presidents in ancient Rome. No, we never had any presidents when we had monarchies. So this president word, yeah, that seems to come from corporations anyway, which does sort of tend to make you think that the United States of America is going to be one big corporation.
Same there. Can I just say board of directors. Brief as well, like, there's one photograph in there where I don't think anybody's mentioned just yet, but it mentions about the power. You know, the Rothschild said there's a technique to power, and it shows that one of the Rothschilds poking Prince Charles in the chest, and Prince Charles looking like a lost little boy. And if anybody doubts the power of the Rothschilds, just take a look at that photograph.
Well, they do. They have them all in hock. I mean, this is how they got their power, wasn't it? It was by loaning out money to the aristocracy and getting the aristocracy in debt. I mean, there's nothing like having somebody in debt to have a power over them, to wield a power over these people. Leverage over them. You think, you know, you're going to lose your home, you're going to lose your house unless you do what the banker's telling you. I mean, we might not get that at our level of society, but Churchill got it. If you're running a big business and you have to borrow money, and suddenly they say, well, you know, like your politics, we're not going to loan you any more money. You know, your business is going to go down, isn't it? If you have to keep expanding on this model where everything has to keep expanding and creating more debt, you're going to fall apart.
Who pokes the future king in the chest?
Well, yeah. Well, I think that just shows you.
I mean, that's a lot of power.
They're not so prominent nowadays as they used to be. No. They used to like to be ostentatious with their wealth, didn't they? But they tend to
hide in the background. One just lost a court case, believe it or not. First time ever. Lost about 30 million. I can't remember the details, but it's a given that judge is going to get the bullet somewhere.
Well, it's all become about earning as much money as possible. And you can tell it from when they're talking. All that's important to them is the economy. The idea that the economy should actually work for the people has completely gone. Now it's all about the people working for the economy. That's all that matters to them. You can see it from this Brexit referendum. What everybody voted for was to stop the immigration. They didn't care, couldn't care less about the economy. The Welsh people have been bribed by the EU, but they still voted to leave the EU because the people are more important. Stopping the immigration is more important. But the government, they don't care about that. All they want to do is get the economy going again. And the economy is based on this system that's based entirely on usury. And it's not a white man's system. It's a weapon of war. Usury is a weapon of war. Again, our whole monetary system is based on another of these,
Talmudic.
Quiet weapons.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Quiet
it's
weapons.
Satanic, in other words.
Yeah, but ways to grind us down where it makes a few people exceedingly rich and a lot of people very poor and siphons off all the wealth from the nation into another nation, another person's pockets.
We all know where that is.
Yeah, this is being exported all over the world along with all these other quiet weapons. You know, these closed circuit TV cameras, you would never even need to have them if we had an ethnostate. You wouldn't have to have any of this oppressive anti-terrorist legislation that they're talking about. I mean, they're talking about even more today, of course.
I think they're for tracking as well, because I heard a police, one of them high-ranking police officers say once that he wanted every road in Britain with a camera on, you know, because then there is no hiding place, you know what I mean?
Well, there'd be no excuse for it if we didn't have Muslims over here, if we didn't have a threat for people to be worried about being blown up there would be no need for them to have this these intrusive technologies or to be asking to see what you're writing or see what you're reading.
Yeah, the only reason still have it, mate.
Yeah, but the only excuse they can come up with for it is terrorism, and the only reason we have terrorism is because we have Muslims in our countries. That's the only reason for it. Just today they're saying in France, well, France is just going to have to get used to terrorist atrocities happening there now. There's nothing we can do about it. All we can do is be more intrusive in the citizens' lives and get them to give up more freedoms. You know, there's no mention of actually getting rid of the people that cause all the terrorism. Nothing about that. No, nobody's saying, well, hang on a minute, it's always Muslims that are doing this. Hang on a minute, the guy driving the truck, his name was Mohammed. Hang on a minute, the guy shooting people up in the Bataclan concert, oh, his name was Mohammed. They're all named Mohammed. How about we get rid of everyone named Mohammed? That'll stop these terrorist atrocities, won't it?
Well, London turned English again if you did that.
Yeah, you know, you would think it's so simple. You know, if you had an ethnostate just made up out of the British
people.
You
mean like Israel?
Yeah. Well, you wouldn't have this. You know, well, Israel gets terrorism, but that's because they got Palestinians there living among them because they stole their land off the Palestinians. It is the most simplest option, and it amazes me that more people don't actually bring it up. You know, is everybody completely taken in by the lies that the government put across every celebrity? Really?
Well, TV's a powerful influence.
But we used to have aristocracy, Dennis. We used to have aristocracy that used to stand up against the government and used to speak up for the people. And they've all gone.
I think UKIP did to an extent, but not you know, we certainly don't get it in droves.
Well, look at UKIP now. They're leaderless. Nigel Farage has backed down, saying that he's had too many death threats. Where are they? You know, you've got the supposed alternative music scene. You've got Bob Geldof. And what's Bob Geldof doing? Well, he's campaigning for the EU.
Yeah, well, his daughter in the OTT, that says it all, doesn't it? And he probably is as well. So he's been home. So I haven't got much time for the Geldofs.
Oh, they're all traitors. Now, at least in Hitler's time, there were some of the capitalists that were on his side, and there were some of the aristocracy that were on his side. But we don't see very much of that nowadays. People just don't speak up about it.
No, well, it's like I said, it's all gone insular now. I mean, even at the end of this past 20, I had Margaret Thatcher, being green and pushing this global warming. As if Margaret Thatcher could ever be green. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, she's a Rothschild puppet as well. You know, people didn't realise at the time. So, you know, but it's a good episode. It's a good episode, and I encourage people to go and watch the rest of it on the Who's Running America on YouTube.
But it's not the last one then?
I think the next one will be the last one, I think.
Any ideas what it's going to feature? Any ideas of the content yet?
Well, I said a couple of weeks ago, I'm going to finish on a earth-shattering atomic bomb. Wins all arguments, hands down.
So you've already got that just in waiting. It's just if
that came in about a month ago, that little piece of research. Couldn't believe I found it. Couldn't believe the excuses what were being made by the people who had discovered it, because they didn't carry water at all.
So you're just waiting, and in case something else pops up, and
in part 25 of Adolf, the greatest story ever told, I didn't learn about the Soviet imminent invasion until a week before I finished the documentary. That is the gospel truth. I had no idea.
This was a Soviet imminent invasion of Europe when
Stalin. Yeah, where he preempted Hitler by 2 weeks.
I thought that was in one of the earlier episodes. I thought that was in one of the earlier episodes.
No, I mentioned it right at the end. You know, it's all scrolling up with the dramatic music. I have no idea.
I mean, that really proved it, didn't it? I mean, that proved that Hitler really saved the whole of Western Europe from Bolshevization by his preemptive strike against Russia. And you still get people today that, that don't believe that and that argue that, but that actually came out from
the archives,
secret archives, didn't it? The Russian secret archives that they spoke about that.
Yeah, when communism fell in the 90s.
And just to take it back to this part 20, and where you're talking about the way that the people have been used as a collateral. This also ties in a bit, I think, with the free man on the land concepts and the sovereign citizen things, where people are persons and they're no longer real people, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, and communism, of course, does not agree with private property, but Hitler was one of those who gave the land back to the farmers and gave it to the farmers to hand down to the sons and the sons to hand down to their sons. But as soon as the war was over, there you go, the Jews moved in back to square one.
Well, that was the traditional law. You couldn't actually sell the land because what were your descendants going to live on?
Exactly.
And the idea of taking over the land like that, that didn't come until William the Norman came over in 1066 with his Jews there to act as tax collectors. And before then, you just couldn't sell the land because it had to be passed on. And the idea of actually selling the land to a foreigner, I mean, that just wouldn't even be countenanced. Yeah. I mean, even today in Syria, that's part of the law in Syria. You're not allowed to sell the land to a foreigner. Foreigners can't
Israel just go along and steal it.
Yeah, this whole idea of the EU and the New World Order, globalization, it's all about just everything being bought up by the richest so that they can get richer and you get poorer. And it's no longer just national. It's international.
You know, this and don't they live longer as well? How old is that Ralph Fellman now?
Well, it amazes me looking at some of these pictures you have of these like these old Jews, these old rich Jews.
Rockefeller.
So evil looking, aren't they? Yeah. Really evil and ugly. I mean, they really do get the face they deserve, I think.
Well, Kissinger's been going forever, him. He must be a clone.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me if they were.
They cloned the sheep in 86, didn't they? Whatever it were.
Well, they did,
I'm sure they're bloody cloning other people.
Well, I just think it wouldn't surprise me if they were injecting them with some illegal type of hormones or stem cells or something from this.
Well,
from
I
this
heard
new
that the royal family actually have blood transfusions once a month because fresh blood. Scientists have discovered it has something to do with prolonging youth. So, although Queen's husband Luke's, 150, he actually moves like he's only 60.
Well, I'd imagine, fresh blood would reinvigorate people, wouldn't it? And they used to say that Lemmy had had a complete blood transfusion and Mick Jagger had a complete blood transfusion. I really wouldn't want... the idea, really, of having somebody else's blood in you. I mean, you really wouldn't want Negro blood in you.
Oh, well, but this is where the magic thing comes from, isn't it? Because they say that there's the fear of a child or a virgin, that fear produces some kind of adrenaline in the blood. And if the child is killed and the blood is drank quick enough, that chemical then enters your body and you inherit the youth of this kid what's just died. This is so I'm told. Not that I've ever tried it. I never will, but,
Now, the adrenaline and the hormones. I think you covered that in one of the earlier episodes of Communism by the Back Door. That covers in with the Jews and their blood drinking rituals, doesn't it?
This is what
they were accused of doing, harvesting the blood of young Christian children for use in magic arts and curses and for drinking it. These are the accusations that were laid at the foot of the Jews,
and all these burnt offerings as well, Sven. When they went about their Holocaust, the Christians. There's nobody been more Holocausted than Christians in the last 20th century. Firebomb cities, and you know what I'm saying. These are proper Holocaust, proper burnt offerings.
Yeah, not pretend Jews being turned into lampshades or gassed, and there's no evidence, not one autopsy. Not one autopsy report of any gassed victims in World War II. Right, Dennis, we're fast approaching the end of the podcast. Do you want to quickly let people know where they can find your work before we finish?
Yeah, you can find me at YouTube, Dennis Wise channel. Got the DVD available at, I think it's truthwithout.tv, or you can go to Greatest Story Never Told.tv. And soon, you know, hopefully, Communism by the Back Door will also be on sale as well, once we've completed it and put all the sources and wrapped it up in nice presentations.
And they can find your YouTube channel at Dennis Wise, I do believe.
That's correct.
Well, thank you very much for coming on once again, Dennis. Thank you very much, Mr. Schmidt. For your presentation. Excellent once again. And we'll be back here at the same time, same place next week. So do tune in for more Truthful Out Radio next Friday.